history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this incredible country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. On Veterans Day and every day, we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take these trips back in time, we learn so much. We're educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In a nation where the differences we carry are currently pretty evident, I hope that this Veterans Day weekend is an opportunity to remind us of one thing on which we should all be able to agree. Those men and women who have served in our armed forces deserve our recognition and our thanks. Maybe you should thank the veterans in your life by taking them to see Hacksaw Ridge, the new movie that tells the true story of Medal of Honor recipient Desmond Doss, who saved the lives of more than 75 men on Okinawa. That was the last major battle of World War II, but in the weeks ahead, you're going to be hearing a whole lot about the day that the war started for the U.S. We'll experience so many 75th anniversaries over the next couple of years, but December 7th will mark 75 years since more than 2,400 Americans were killed in Imperial Japan's surprise attack on the island of Oahu. Over the years, we've been privileged to hear from dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors on Hometown Heroes, and I have set up links for all of those full interviews for you at hometownheroesradio.com, but I wanted to share some relevant parts of some of their stories with you today to give you a little perspective on everything you're going to be seeing and hearing and reading about Pearl Harbor in the weeks ahead. I thought I'd give you a few different pieces to the puzzle of a multifaceted attack that shocked the world and famously brought to life a sleeping giant, galvanizing a nation that would put 16 million Americans in uniform by the end of the war. One of those already in uniform and on the island for that fateful day was a young Native American from southeastern Arizona who had enlisted just 2 months earlier. Francisco Paredes was proud of his Mescalero Apache heritage and thankful to know a sailor from his hometown was on Oahu with him.
A friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him, and we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know, and I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu, because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times. But you're a 21-year-old kid. You're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life. I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that. I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming out. And I think that'll go on forever because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know, her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to grave registration. It took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
I can't imagine that being easy to see this death and destruction all around you. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with it at the time?
Well, you have to deal with whatever comes along. You have to deal with it, you know, one way or the other. Some people, as a rule, you know, deals like what I went through, they'd go bananas. But I kept my wits, you know, and I'm doing fine as of now, you know. And I'm still doing great.
What's the secret? How do you do that?
You would have to ask me that. I think it's my Indian heritage. As I was growing up, I did a lot of things what the Indians did. When I can, you know, believe it or not, I do powwows at Table Mountain Casino here in California. Once in a while, I go to Window Rock, Arizona, because I had some original Code Talkers in Window Rock, and they're all buried in Fort Defiance, Arizona.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, those three words that seem to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
Frank would do that for the rest of the war, despite being wounded on three separate occasions. He's 96 now. He'll be 97 in February. And when I spoke with him this week, he was giving me his ideas for fundraising for Honor Flight, so more veterans could visit their memorials in Washington, D.C. the way he did. Quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors are going to be back on Oahu for the 75th anniversary, including some of the men we've heard from in recent weeks here on Hometown Heroes, and also 98-year-old Eugene Leonard, who will surely have some memories flooding back when he looks at the land near Barber's Point that once was home to Marine Corps Air Station Eva. That's where he was 75 years ago. Did you have any idea before December 7th? Was there any concern that the Japanese might attack?
None at all. Absolutely surprised.
Tell me about that Sunday morning. What's the first thing you remember?
I remember the airplanes flying about, 8-10 miles away. Coming in, they looked different, but they was tiny. You know, that's quite a ways away. And I could see torpedoes hanging halfway below the airplane. The nose would be pointed down from the airplane. That's what they used to sink the different ships.
So when you first saw the airplanes, did you think?
We discussed it. You know, all the guys, we stand colored, you know, your mom.
Yeah.
But, hey, what's going on? Hey, them, they look different. And as soon as that's over, of course, I had to go to my guard station. And when we went to the guard station, when we was attacked for this base, see, this is the first airplane come over our way, attacked the truck that I was in.
When you first saw those planes, did you think they were American planes?
Oh, no. I could see that red thing.
Even when they were far away, though? I mean, when you saw them on the horizon?
I didn't know what there was when they were far away. We didn't know what there was.
So did it start to trigger maybe something's wrong here?
No, I really didn't know something was wrong at all until we got in the ring and that plane come after us. Then I knew something was wrong. We knew right then, but it's already too late. We didn't have anything to do.
So you and another guard are driving a truck. How big a truck?
Just a pickup with a flatbed.
So you don't have much protection?
No protection whatsoever.
And the very first plane that comes in that's firing
at that truck. They was coming in from the north side of the island and across. And we could see them going across to Pearl Harbor. And you see, they just broke off. They had to get our airplanes too, you know.
Yeah.
And because they broke off. See, there was Schofield Barracks and Wheeler Armor Air, all them. They was attacking them all at the same time.
And you guys at your field had, what, about 40 or 50 airplanes?
Well, there was three squadrons, and we only had about eight in our squadron. And then there's dive bombing, a fighter squadron, and another a scout bomber squadron.
And so some of those planes are planes that, had you guys been able to get them in the air, could have fought with the Japanese planes and inhibited the damage.
The rear gunners and all that would be after them, and the fighter planes and everything.
But they were able to destroy them all right there on the ground.
They destroyed them on the ground. No ammunition anywhere.
And they almost destroyed you. So your truck, the Japanese plane is firing machine gun bullets right at you. You got out of the truck. And
I got out of it, so did the other guy.
And you had an idea of where a safe place to go would be. Tell me what that was.
Well, that was the big building where the morning mask was, where the holes was in the ground.
So this Eva Field had been used in World War I with dirigibles, inflatable airships.
Right.
But you knew that in that building, as kind of a leftover of the old technology, there were these big holes
That's
in the ground.
Right. There's just holes in the ground.
How big around were they?
Oh, it wasn't round. It was long, probably that wide.
4 or 5 feet?
Maybe, 4 feet, 5 feet long.
So you and the other guy run in there and jump in those holes?
He didn't follow me. No. I just went for the, I don't know where he went.
So you just knew that's a safe place to go?
I was trying to get away from the bullets is all I knew.
So you hopped down in this hole. Was there anything else in that hole?
No.
Nothing crawling on you?
Well, like I say, scorpions was all over the place, and was and spiders and all that. So that's about all that's around.
So you preferred a bug bite to a Japanese bullet?
I preferred. I knew the holes were there. See, I was second in rank. The number one sergeant in rank was killed probably 75 feet from where I was at. He got out there for. Grabbed a fire extinguisher where the airplanes was, and he got shot.
Were you guys pretty defenseless at that point?
We was defenseless.
You didn't have anti-aircraft guns or anything like that?
We didn't have anything, no ammunition or anything.
So the best thing you could have done is what you did, because there was nothing you were going to do to the Japanese. You just had to make sure you survived. What was it like to be in that hole And what were you hearing? What was happening around you?
All I heard was the rattle of the building of the machine gun fire hitting it. I was trying to save myself. I didn't know what was going on except that I was being shot at.
When the building stopped rattling and you came out of there, what did you see? What was the scene around you?
Airplanes on fire, just piles of planes are burning. All that fuel had to be burnt. See, it's burning everywhere.
So much of Oahu was burning that Sunday morning. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from a man who was flying an American bomber into that chaotic scene on December 7th, 1941. For photos and links to all of these complete interviews, visit hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.